KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Over 80% of people with opioid use disorder still don't get this life-saving treatment.
Will Republican budget cuts make it harder for people addicted to fentanyl and other drugs to get help?
Today is Monday, April 14th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead this hour, how Trump administration reforms at the State Department are shrinking America's diplomatic footprint.
There's an intelligent way to reduce the size of the overseas footprint, but you can also do it stupidly.
Also, a true crime story that went viral and was completely made up, generated by AI.
What ethical questions does that raise?
This way, people can have all the luridness they want, but it's not hurting people. So I see it myself sort of like the vegan alternative to true crime.
Those stories and more coming up after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. President Donald Trump is talking more about deporting U.S. citizens to El Salvador. He floated the idea to El Salvador's Nayib Bukele, the president, who visited the White House today and has already accepted more than 200 non-citizen deportees. Here's NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben.
Trump has for months suggested deporting what he calls homegrown criminals. In the Oval Office, he promoted the idea to Bukele in a video posted to Bukele's social media.
Homegrowns are next. The homegrowns built. You got to build about five more places.
Yeah, that's fair. All right.
Trump suggested Bukele build five more places, seeming to mean five more prisons to house U.S. deportees. Trump later said he and his team were, quote, studying the laws about this possibility. He said he wants to deport violent people. But many legal scholars say it would be blatantly unconstitutional to deport American citizens, violent or not. Danielle Kurtzleben, NPR News, The White House.
A man authorities say scaled an iron fence and set the Pennsylvania governor's mansion on fire was arraigned today and denied bail. Authorities say the suspect, identified as 38-year-old Cody Ballmer, did not enter a plea. Ballmer, who police say turned himself in, said he was also prepared to attack Governor Josh Shapiro with a hammer had he encountered him. Shapiro and his family were at home at the time of the attack but were unharmed. The fire caused extensive damage to the governor's mansion. In North Carolina, a group of voters is asking a federal court to block state election officials from throwing out thousands of ballots cast last year by U.S. citizens living abroad, including U.S. military members. NPR's Hansi Luong explains its latest twist in a long-running legal fight over an election for a seat on North Carolina's state Supreme Court.
More than 5 months after Election Day 2024, Republican challenger Jefferson Griffin is continuing to push to get courts to toss thousands of ballots cast in this race. Democratic incumbent Allison Riggs is currently leading by 734 votes after two recounts. That could change after last week's ruling by the Republican majority of North Carolina's state Supreme Court. It focused in part on roughly 5,000 overseas voters who, under state election rules, were not required to provide copies of their photo ID with their ballots. But the state court has now ordered a 30-day period for those voters to provide a copy of their ID if they want their ballots to count. The League of Women Voters in North Carolina and other groups are challenging that ruling in federal court. They argue the ruling violates the Constitution by disenfranchising voters through changing voting requirements after an election. Hansi Luong, NPR News.
Chipmaker NVIDIA says it will build new AI computer chip factories in the U.S. over the next 4 years. The company says it's already begun work at a facility in Arizona and will also build supercomputer manufacturing facilities in Texas. Within the four-year time frame, NVIDIA says it will invest upwards of $500,000 in AI infrastructure in the U.S. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street today. The Dow is up 312 points. This is NPR. Kicking off a diplomatic tour of Southeast Asia with a visit to Vietnam, Chinese leader Xi Jinping made the point that no one wins in a trade war. Xi making the comments as the world's two largest economies, the U.S. and China, continue their tit-for-tat tariff battle. While the Trump administration has paused some tariffs, it's kept in place a 145% duty on goods imported to the U.S. from China. China retaliated with a 125% tariff of its own. The Army civilian leadership has ordered Army libraries, including West Point to remove all books that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion, as well as gender and critical race theory. That's according to a memo sent last week by a top Army official. More from NPR's Tom Bowman.
The memo obtained by NPR and written by Acting Secretary of the Army Derek Anderson says books promoting diversity, gender, and race, quote, subverts meritocracy and unity. It says a list of books should be provided to the Army's chief librarian by April 16th. Besides West Point, the memo was also sent to the Army War College. The move comes after the U.S. Naval Academy removed nearly 400 books from Nimitz Library that had similar topics. Those books included Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
A Blue Origin rocket with an all-female crew that included the fiancé of company founder Jeff Bezos blasted into space for a brief mission today. Along with Lauren Sanchez, a helicopter pilot, singer Katy Perry, and journalist Gail King were on board. Fully automated mission only lasted about 11 minutes before the six-person crew returned to Earth. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. Hundreds of thousands of people facing addiction to fentanyl and other drugs could lose access to treatment if Republicans succeed in making deep cuts to Medicaid. That was the message today from Democratic lawmakers, also doctors and drug policy experts. NPR addiction correspondent Brian Mann is with me. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So start just by making clear, what is the connection here between Medicaid and drug addiction?
Yeah, Medicaid is this program funded jointly by the federal government and by states that provides health insurance now to more than 80 million mostly low-income Americans. And under the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid expanded to include coverage for addiction treatment. And that happened, Mary Louise, just as the overdose crisis was surging. So now Medicaid is by far the biggest program paying for addiction care in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And this new report issued today by Democratic lawmakers found roughly a million people are right now getting health care for opioid addiction through Medicaid. Democratic Senator Maggie Hassan from New Hampshire said that recovery system could unravel.
If there are even small cuts to the federal share of Medicaid funding, many states across the country, including New Hampshire, have laws on the books that would automatically terminate Medicaid expansion and kick people off of their health care, including for addiction treatment.
Now, Mary Louise, obviously Republicans are talking about really big cuts. One proposal floated by GOP lawmakers would shrink Medicaid funding by more than $2 trillion over the next decade.
$2 trillion. And why? What is the argument here for big cuts like this to healthcare spending?
Yeah, GOP lawmakers have long been hostile to the Affordable Care Act, which expanded Medicaid. They say it costs taxpayers too much money. Part of these cuts would also go to pay for some of the big tax breaks that are a central part of President Trump's economic agenda. Speaking yesterday on the Fox News show Sunday Morning Futures, House Speaker Mike Johnson said programs like Medicaid are also padded with waste and fraud.
We have to eliminate people on, for example, on Medicaid who are not actually eligible to be there. Able-bodied workers, for example, young men who should never be on the program at all.
Now, a couple of points here. Critics don't actually think there's enough fraud or waste in Medicaid to pay for the kind of big cuts Republicans are talking about. And it's also worth noting young men, who Johnson mentioned there, they're actually highly vulnerable to addiction. Fentanyl is still one of the leading causes of death for men under the age of 50.
Okay, well, that's interesting because I know you have been out front reporting about drug overdose deaths and how they are actually finally dropping, which prompts the question, is there still as much need for this kind of addiction treatment?
Yeah, that's right. There has been this hopeful shift, tens of thousands fewer overdose deaths each year. But here's the thing. Experts say a lot of those people are surviving, but they still need a lot of health care and help to fully recover. They're still deeply addicted. Dr. Brian Hurley, who heads the American Society of Addiction Medicine, says the U.S. actually needs more funding to get more people into medication treatment and therapy.
We're still in a treatment gap where over 80% of people with opioid use disorder still don't get this life-saving treatment. Payment is an essential part of healthcare services.
Republicans are still hashing out details of this budget, Mary Louise, but if Medicaid funding is cut, we could see a lot of people lose their health insurance and a lot of hospitals and treatment clinics close.
Okie dokie. NPR's Brian Mann, he covers addiction. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Mark Zuckerberg took the witness stand today. The Meta CEO testified before a judge in the Federal Trade Commission's landmark trial, which began this morning. It's the result of a nearly six-year investigation into whether Meta broke competition laws in becoming a tech giant. We will note that Meta is an NPR sponsor, but we report on it just like with any other company we cover. NPR's Bobby Allen joins us now from the courthouse in Washington, D.C. Hi, Bobby.
Hey there.
Hey. Okay, so was it expected that Zuckerberg would actually show up and testify today?
Yes and no. I mean, the FTC had Zuckerberg on a witness list among dozens of others, but this is supposed to be an eight-week trial. Nobody anticipated him taking the stand today. Zuckerberg is the government's star witness, after all, and, you know, most thought the government would save him until later in the trial, but he managed to elude photographers in entering the courthouse. So I and the rest of the reporters covering this had no idea he was even here.
Wow.
So it really delivered a surprise to the packed courtroom when Zuckerberg's name was called and he walked into the courtroom in a suit and tie.
Okay, so what did he say?
Well, so far, a lawyer for the Federal Trade Commission is going over Meta's early history. Zuckerberg said from the witness stand that he rejected advice early on that he should sell the company because it just wouldn't be able to compete with MySpace. That was the advice way back when. Mm-hmm. Zuckerberg then described launching Facebook's newsfeed in 2006. And from there, Zuckerberg explained the rationale behind various product updates to Facebook. The day ended by Zuckerberg being grilled about when Meta started thinking about acquiring Instagram, having him read old emails about this. And Elsa, this is all setting the foundation for the FTC's case, which is expected to get a lot more juicy tomorrow.
Okay, so about the FTC's case, can you just step back and say more about what is the FTC alleging here about Meta?
Yeah, so the FTC says instead of competing with other tech companies, Meta purchased rivals to neutralize them. In particular, FTC says Meta buying Instagram in 2012 and WhatsApp 2 years later were done because Meta was worried about competition from these two companies. The FTC put up Zuckerberg's emails on screens to the courtroom, showing that Zuckerberg himself wrote internal messages saying Instagram and WhatsApp were business threats. The FTC says after Meta purchased Instagram and WhatsApp, they got bigger, they got more powerful, and all of Meta's services got worse.
Huh, okay, well, how is Meta responding to those claims?
Yeah, Meta's legal team says the acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp were already approved more than 10 years ago when it happened, and that forcing Meta to spin these two companies off as the FTC wants would have a chilling effect across Silicon Valley, that it would deter tech startups from growing, making acquisitions, being innovative. Meta also says it is not as dominant as the FTC claims. Meta argues it competes with TikTok, with YouTube, with Snapchat, and many other apps vying for everyone's attention. So Meta says loud and clear it is not a monopoly.
Well, what do you think would happen if Meta did have to spin off Instagram and WhatsApp?
Yeah, Meta is a $1.3 trillion company, one of the most valuable companies in the world, right? Uh-huh. And most of that money comes from advertising. Its ad systems are super integrated across all of its apps. So if Meta had to spin off Instagram and WhatsApp, it would really be a big blow to that advertising engine. It would just really strike at the heart of how Meta collects data, how it analyzes data, and how it serves all of us apps. All of us ads across all of its major services. So this could be quite devastating to the bottom line of Meta if the judge does rule against the company here.
A lot at stake. That is NPR's Bobby Allen. Thank you, Bobby.
Thanks, Elsa.
Novelist Mario Vargas Llosa died yesterday at the age of 89. He was one of the most celebrated writers in Latin America and the first Peruvian to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. NPR's Mandalit del Barco has our remembrance.
Mario Vargas Llosa was born in Arequipa, Peru, and he was told his father had died, but that wasn't true. His parents reunited when he was 10, as he told WHYY's Fresh Air in 1994.
Until then, I had been, a very spoiled child. And suddenly, I started to live with a man who was very rigorous, very strict.
Vargas Llosa took refuge in reading. His revenge was to write poetry. His father disapproved.
My father, as many middle-class people in Latin America in the 50s, thought that to be a writer was to be an eccentric, as someone marginal.
Sent to military school, Vargas Llosa wrote his first novel, Ciudad y los Perros, in English, The Time of the Hero. The 1963 novel depicted the corruption of the school, the military, and Peruvian society, as he told NPR in 2010.
It's a novel that tried to describe the consequences of a military authoritarian system.
Vargas Llosa said the school's leaders burned 1,000 copies in the courtyard. While he was still a teen, Vargas Llosa became a journalist for local newspapers. He wrote plays and short stories and studied law and literature at Lima's Universidad de San Marcos. When he was 19, Vargas Llosa married his uncle's sister-in-law. She was 13 years older. He fictionalized that marriage in his 1977 novel, Aunt Julia and the Scriptwriter.
I wonder what your father would have said if he'd heard you.
I don't care.
After Vargas Llosa and his aunt divorced, he married his first cousin. They remained married for 50 years. The couple moved to Europe, and the locales of Vargas Llosa's novels expanded beyond Latin America. His politics changed, too. Vargas Llosa abandoned his support for the Cuban Revolution and socialism, and he returned to Peru to lead a coalition opposing a plan to nationalize the banks. In 1990, he ran for president.
He abandonado mis libros, mi escritorio, mi vocación que yo amo tanto.
I've left behind my books and my desk, he said in a speech. He also ran against the brutal terrorism of the Sendero Luminoso, the Shining Path Maoist rebel group, which killed an estimated 70,000 Peruvians, as he told NPR.
They tried to kill me twice, and they were ferocious.
Vargas Llosa's political opponents criticized his turn to the center-right. He lost to Alberto Fujimori, who Vargas Llosa sharply criticized in his 1993 memoir, A Fish in the Water. He told Fresh Air the book made him very unpopular at first.
But things have been changing since, and now apparently the regime is much more unpopular than myself. So I'm not so unpopular now, apparently, in Peru.
Vargas Llosa also had a famous literary feud with Nobel Prize-winning Colombian novelist Gabriel García Márquez. Both were stars of the Latin American literary boom of the 1960s. But their friendship ended when Vargas Llosa punched García Márquez in the eye. Vargas Llosa won his Nobel Literature Prize in 2010.
Gracias a la literatura para protagonizar las grandes aventuras.
Thanks to literature, he said in his speech, we can be protagonists in the great adventures, the great passions real life will never give us. The lies of literature become truths through us. The readers transformed, infected with longings, and through the fault of fiction, permanently questioning a mediocre reality. Mandalit del Barco, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. From Amazon Business, offering business buying services from office supplies to IT essentials and maintenance tools to help bring visions to life. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ilse Chang. Our next story plays with the line between fact and fiction. It begins with a mysterious video.
Today, we uncover the tragic and complex story of Richard Engelbert, a successful real estate agent whose hidden life and secrets led to his brutal murder.
The crime had supposedly taken place in a city outside Denver more than a decade ago, or that's what viewers were led to believe. Reporter Henry Larson picks up the story from here for our regular segment of short-form audio documentaries.
Elizabeth Hernandez had never heard about the case of Richard Engelbert. She's a reporter at the Denver Post, and back in August, people started sending her newsroom a bunch of emails all about this one YouTube video.
My editor said, like, hey, we're getting these messages. We have this thing from a tip line. Do you want to look at this video?
The video was called Husband's Secret Gay Love Affair with Stepson Ends in Grisly Murder. Almost 2 million people had watched it.
The truth about Richard's life and death had been revealed, but the scars left behind would take much longer to heal. The trial of
that stilted narration was accompanied by these hazy images of houses against some mountains and headshots of suspects and victims.
Can you describe to me the tips? What did they say?
At least one of them said something along the lines of, why hasn't the Denver Post covered this?
What did you feel when you read that?
Rage.
Rage. Because this crime readers were writing in about and blaming her paper for missing actually hadn't happened.
To me, it was very evident that it was not real pretty quickly. I was at the Denver Post in 2014 and probably would have remembered a very salacious case like this.
She called law enforcement sources and quickly confirmed her suspicions. The video was fake. The characters, the plot, the narrator, all generated by AI. The video belonged to a YouTube channel called True Crime Case Files. It was one of more than 150 videos on the page. A lot of them were hypersexual or hyperviolent. None of them were real. They'd all been created with AI and pretended to be about real places and people, and commenters were buying it.
The point is, it needs to be called true crime because true crime is a genre. It's not just two words melded together. It's a genre, true crime.
Can you tell me your name?
My name's John.
And John, that's your real first name?
Yes, that's my real first name.
And we're not using your last name, right?
Yes, we're not.
John and I started talking late last year. He was reluctant to go on the record, but agreed to chat over the phone in December. John said he started receiving hate mail and threats a while ago because of his videos, so NPR isn't using his last name to protect his identity. I was really fascinated with this whole operation. There are lots of people who lie on the internet, but it felt like John was lying in a brand new way. It started after he graduated college, when the pandemic was in full swing.
Me and my family, because I was staying with my family then, ended up binge-watching Dateline, because you know that there's like 20 seasons of Dateline. Each was like 40 episodes. So, I mean, you can watch it for hours and hours.
John taught himself the show's formula. A scandalous affair, some brutal crime, and a stunning trial of a perpetrator to bring things home. Around this time, John also started trying out ChatGPT. He experimented with making parodies of another kind of super formulaic content, Hallmark movies. He uploaded these videos with titles like Romance and Reindeer to YouTube. They were pretty simple, but John also made sure to include a note on each one disclosing that they were AI generated.
Why'd you stop?
Well, because I realized it didn't do well, and I labeled it AI parody, and it didn't do well. I think the best one maybe got 20 views.
The lesson John learned was that people wouldn't watch videos tagged as AI generated. Then, around Thanksgiving 2 years ago, John also realized he could combine his AI video know-how with what he learned watching all that Dateline, and True Crime Case Files was born. This time, though, there was no mention the videos were made up, or that they used AI. For months, he cranked out these videos, uploading sometimes two or three a week. He got about 100,000 subscribers, and his videos sometimes got 10 times that number in views. He told me he was making enough to live on. Here's the thing that made me keep calling John. He believes what he's doing is better than real true crime, because his stories don't use the suffering of real people as content.
At the end of the day, true crime, no matter how much it's dressed up as we care about the victims or this is about finding justice, it's a form of entertainment.
Yeah. But, I mean, if you are so critical of true crime, and if it's causing all these problems in the world, why are you making it?
I'm creating an alternative to it. Because in this way, people can have all the luridness they want, but it's not hurting people. So I see of myself sort of like the vegan alternative to true crime.
Lots of people agree with John about this part, that true crime, popular as it is, has real problems. A 2003 study in the Journal of Communications showed people who watched violent, dramatic television news were more worried about crime. Nationwide, violent crime has been declining for decades, and yet, polling consistently shows Americans believe crime is rising. Considering the tips sent to the Denver Post, some locals believed John's video, too. For some of John's critics, that's a problem.
I found myself in this world on May 19th, 2012, when my sister Mickey Schunick went missing. She was abducted and murdered by a stranger. It was a really high-profile case for the time.
That's Charlie Schunick. These days, she's a missing persons advocate. Charlie estimates there have been thousands of videos, documentaries, and podcasts all made about her sister's death. She knows from her own experience that real true crime can re-victimize survivors. But as long as John keeps pretending his videos are true, she thinks he isn't any better.
The fact that people are calling in about these fake cases is one of the things that just enrages me. It's so hard, especially for cold case or long-term missing person cases, to get any type of attention and support, and sometimes to even get law enforcement or media to respond to a call, email, DM. And the fact that they're gonna dedicate time and resources to fake cases because the people making these don't have the decency to say that they're not real, it's infuriating.
When you press John about all this, though, about the kind of impact his videos might have, it falls flat. Do you have misgivings about what you do?
No, I don't. It's an absurdist art form. If people don't understand it, then that says a lot about human nature and their own natures and the nature of true crime, and perhaps they're not willing to question themselves. But I don't have any misgivings about what I'm doing.
While reporting the story, I went to YouTube for comment about John's videos. A few days later, they told me they had deleted his channel. Not because the videos were made by AI or that he lied about them being true. They were deleted for violating policies prohibiting child sexual exploitation. John disputes this. He says all of his characters were over the age of 18. But John's still making content. He uploads the stories as podcasts now, and he has copycats. YouTube channels with names like Hidden Family Crime Stories, True Crime Cases, and Crime Tapes are pumping out more and more AI-generated true crime videos every day.
That was reporter Henry Larson. A version of this story first appeared in 404 Media.
This is NPR News.
Her South Asian-inspired ice cream shop, Malai, is the star of Pooja Bavishi's new cookbook.
The goal was always to change the way that ice cream is perceived in this country. Why isn't it as typical and normal to pull a pint of masala chai from your grocery store freezer as it is a pint of cookies and cream?
A visit to one of her ice cream shops in Washington, D.C. tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Coming up, a live stream on YouTube has offered viewers a glimpse of life in a coral reef near Miami.
We have Lisa the lemon shark, who has this Mona Lisa smile. You begin to recognize that they really do live here. It's their neighborhood.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. The man who oversaw the dismantlement of the U.S. Agency for International Development has left the State Department. NPR's Michelle Kellerman tells us his departure comes just months into the second Trump administration.
The State Department says that Pete Morocco was brought to the department to conduct an exhaustive review of every dollar spent on foreign assistance. The statement says Morocco, quote, exposed egregious abuses, adding, quote, we all expect big things are in store for Pete on his next mission. The department did not say what that might be. A Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Brian Schott, says Morocco's tenure brought what he called reckless and unlawful policy to the State Department. He says he wants to hear directly from Secretary of State Marco Rubio about the future of U.S. foreign assistance. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
A federal judge in Colorado has issued an order blocking two Venezuelan men from being deported. From Colorado Public Radio, Allison Sherry reports it's the latest lawsuit challenging the Trump administration's efforts to deport alleged gang members.
The federal government says the two men, a 25-year-old and a 32-year-old, identified only by their initials in court documents, are members of the gang Tren de Aragua. They were at risk of immediate removal, and the ACLU of Colorado sought a block on that. The ACLU says the government has it wrong. The two men were fleeing persecution and dangers the gang poses. They were not members of it. Yes, they have tattoos, but those are of family members' names and not related to gang activity. A hearing will be held next week on the men's fates. For NPR News, I'm Allison Sherry in Denver.
Stocks finished higher, as well as shares of Apple, as President Trump temporarily exempted smartphones and some electronics from his stiff tariffs temporarily. This is NPR. President Franklin D. Roosevelt died 80 years ago in Warm Springs, Georgia, and some of his descendants gathered there over the weekend to reflect on the fate of his legacy. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
FDR found relief from polio, soaking in the namesake waters of Warm Springs, Georgia, and he also connected with struggling people in this rural landscape.
What he saw down there informed his political vision of what needed to be done for the nation in the midst of the Great Depression.
FDR's great-grandson, Haven Roosevelt Luke, says the New Deal programs that came from that experience, including Social Security and labor and banking reforms, are under threat as President Trump slashes the federal government.
We're watching FDR's legacy get torn down, death by a thousand cuts.
Luke says FDR never stopped hoping and believing in the nation. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Warm Springs, Georgia.
Well, tomorrow is April 15th, the deadline for most people to file their state and federal income taxes. But if you've experienced a major disaster, think wildfire, hurricane, tornado, flooding, something other, the IRS is providing a six-month extension or until October 15th to file. The agency also warns folks to be extra vigilant preparing their taxes in the wake of a disaster to avoid being scammed. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From Easy Cater, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from a nationwide network of restaurants, create lunch programs for their employees, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. A, quote, unjustified seismic shift in the U.S. foreign policy enterprise. That is how some Democrats are describing the reforms taking place at the State Department. The Trump administration has already gutted the lead U.S. aid agency, and the remnants will now be absorbed by the State Department, which is also facing cutbacks. As NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports, all of this has veteran diplomats worried.
For 100 years, the American Foreign Service Association has supported U.S. diplomats at home and around the world. The Trump administration has stripped it of its collective bargaining rights with the State Department, something AFSA President Tom Yezgardi is now fighting in court.
Without collective bargaining rights, any major initiative, say on assignments or promotions, we no longer have eyes on. That's not only bad for our members, I think it's bad for the Foreign Service.
But it's not only the union's troubles that worry Yezgardi, a veteran Foreign Service officer. He says it's important for the U.S. to have a professional, nonpartisan Foreign Service to help Americans overseas, promote American businesses, and carry out the policy of the president. But right now, he's seeing a lot of talent leaving.
We have more people who have retired in the first 2.5 months of this year than in all of last year. So it's on pace to be a record year. And that's unfortunate because I think we want to also maintain, you know, that senior experience and knowledge. Mentorship is a huge thing in the Foreign Service. We might be losing some of that if we just see a run for the door from our senior Foreign Service members.
The State Department has canceled summer internships. There's a hiring freeze and talk of closing a couple dozen diplomatic posts, including embassies and consulates. Retired Ambassador Ronald Newman of the American Academy of Diplomacy says these kind of cuts can be done smartly.
There's an intelligent way to reduce the size of the overseas footprint, but you can also do it stupidly.
And what he's seen so far from the Trump administration gives him pause. That includes the dismantlement of USAID and a more recent decision to put a junior Foreign Service officer in charge of the State Department's Bureau of Global Talent.
This is like, say, taking a second lieutenant and saying, okay, you should be chief of staff of the Army.
The State Department would not comment on personnel matters related to Lew Olosky, a lawyer and Trump loyalist who joined the Foreign Service 4 years ago. He's now acting as the top official in a bureau usually run by a veteran diplomat confirmed by the Senate. Senator Chris Van Hollen, the ranking Democrat on a foreign relations subcommittee overseeing the department, is alarmed.
Another very alarming proposal would be to replace experienced, knowledgeable, career Foreign Service officers with political hacks.
Van Hollen and other Democrats on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee have written to Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who used to be one of their Republican colleagues on the committee.
Rubio has been pretty much AWOL. I will say that the, you know, Republicans on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee have not been exercising their oversight responsibilities.
Republican Chairman Jim Risch has so far backed the changes the Trump administration is making, saying he did not want USAID to survive. But he says he does plan to have Rubio appear before the committee at some point to talk about the reforms. Van Hollen says things are moving too quickly and America's soft power institutions are suffering.
The Trump administration is doing grave damage to America's ability to conduct diplomacy around the world, and they are leaving the door wide open for China to rush in. And we're already seeing that in many areas where AID has been dismantled.
Democrats say they have seen one positive sign this past weekend. The man who oversaw the dismantlement of USAID, Pete Morocco, has now left the State Department. But in a statement, the department says it expects big things for Morocco's next mission, though it didn't elaborate. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
For 5 years, a continuous live stream on YouTube has captured daily life in a Florida community that few people get the chance to visit, a coral reef in Miami's Biscayne Bay. NPR's Greg Allen reports the Coral City Camera has documented endangered coral in the heart of Miami's busy port, coral that are thriving and remarkably resilient.
Colin Ford spends a lot of time on this spit of land overlooking Miami's port channel. Just offshore in 8 or 9 feet of water is where he mounted a video camera.
As you can see, the water is really gorgeous. It's turquoise blue. And we're standing on this limestone riprap.
Riprap are large pieces of rock, in this case limestone, that armor a shoreline, protecting it from erosion, storm surge, and sea level rise.
These boulders provide great habitat for fish and for corals to recruit onto the limestone. It's geologically basically the same as coral skeleton, so corals are happy to grow on it.
It's a beautiful spot on a busy channel. Huge cruise ships and recreational boaters pass by just 150 feet away. Since Ford installed the video camera 5 years ago, the live feed on YouTube of corals and fish has been viewed more than 3.7 million times. Fans from around the world see that just below the surface in Miami's Biscayne Bay, there's a healthy marine community.
We've got close to 20 different species of stony corals living in one of the busiest ports in the entire world.
In his warehouse and lab several miles inland from the bay, Ford uses a computer to control the camera, changing its angle several times a day. He calls it a free-range aquarium.
Being able to see the regulars, and we have Lisa the lemon shark who has this Mona Lisa smile, you begin to recognize that they really do live here. It's their neighborhood.
Nearly 20 years ago, Ford helped start Coral Morphologic, a company that blends his interest in corals with art. He's been involved in a number of projects, including one during Miami's Art Basel Fair a few years ago. That projected images of coral onto the city's performing arts center.
We approach corals from a slightly different perspective than, you know, the academic or scientific community might. You know, our goal really is to try and reach the public and get them to really fall in love with these organisms that are just so alien that how can you not be captivated by them?
The Coral City Camera shows not just the beauty, but also the resilience of these urban corals. Corals that persist and sometimes thrive in port cities like Miami, Singapore, and Sydney. Ford says that was demonstrated dramatically 2 years ago when record high ocean temperatures caused corals to bleach and in many cases die.
You know, 2023 was an absolutely dreadful year. We watched corals all up and down the Florida Reef Tract bleaching and dying. And yet for the most part, the corals living at the Port of Miami around the Coral City Camera didn't even bleach.
In part because of Ford's work, NOAA research ecologist Ian Enochs has begun studying Miami's urban corals.
They may be genetically stronger, more capable of dealing with environmental conditions that are otherwise killing corals.
Climate change, ocean acidification, and pollution are degrading coral reefs worldwide. In Florida, NOAA and a host of research groups are working to restore the ailing reefs. Enochs says these urban corals may play a key role in that effort.
If we can find individuals that are able to deal with these environmental stressors, if we can grow them, if we can outplant them, then we can create reefs that are more resilient.
To help make that happen, Coral Morphologic is building a lab to cultivate and breed urban coral species. It's one of a number of projects Ford has in the works. This summer, working with other artists and scientists, he'll begin planting corals on an artificial reef that's planned to be 7 miles long and within swimming distance of Miami Beach. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today, the Trump administration has frozen more than $2.2 billion in grants and contracts for Harvard University tonight. This move came after Harvard earlier today rejected the administration's demands that it end diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, among other policy changes, in order to get federal money. NPR's Janaki Mehta has been following all of this and joins us now. Hi, Janaki.
Hey, Alpha.
Hey. Okay, can you start by telling us what the Trump administration wanted Harvard to change about its policies in order to get these federal funds?
Yeah, so on Friday, the administration sent Harvard a list of demands that included asking the university to eliminate DEI programs, as you mentioned, making sure its hiring practices incorporate, quote, viewpoint diversity, and to start screening international students for what the administration considers supporting terrorism or anti-Semitism. Harvard said it would not comply, and now the Trump administration has announced it will freeze over $2.2 billion in multi-year grants and contracts.
And what is Harvard now saying in response to these demands?
So we just heard back from Harvard in response to the latest funding freeze. Mm-hmm. They referred me back to something Harvard's President Alan Garber said earlier today to students and staff in a letter. He said, for the government to retreat from these partnerships now risks not only the health and well-being of millions of individuals, but also the economic security and vitality of our nation. In that same letter, Garber also said the Trump administration was violating the university's rights to free speech, that it was overstepping the government's authority to enforce civil rights. And then, just hours after that, the Trump administration said, quote, Harvard's statement today reinforces a troubling entitlement mindset that is endemic in our nation's most prestigious universities and colleges, that federal investment does not...
We may have lost Janaki. Janaki, can you hear us?
I can hear you, yeah.
There you are. You were just reading Harvard's statement. That federal investment does not come?
Yeah, that federal investment does not come with the responsibility to uphold civil rights laws, the administration said.
I mean, Janaki, we have seen threats to DEI programs across the country, to all kinds of educational institutions, right? It's not just Harvard that's being targeted, yeah?
Yeah, Harvard is certainly not the only university the administration has been after. This is part of a larger push for them to use taxpayer dollars to pressure schools to eliminate diversity programs and other programs that don't align with its agenda. In fact, Vice President J.D. Vance has called universities the enemy. And last month, the administration sent over 60 universities letters warning them that there would be potential enforcement if they didn't fulfill their obligations to protect Jewish students. For higher ed institutions, a lot of this pressure kind of came after a wave of pro-Palestinian protests broke out across campuses last year. Mm-hmm. And the administration has already frozen billions of dollars for other major universities, including Cornell and Columbia. And now, Elsa, we can add Harvard to that list, more than $2.2 billion frozen, over $6 billion more on the line if they don't comply.
So, just tell us, what is this money usually used for at Harvard and at other colleges?
Yeah, a lot of it is used for research. In his letter earlier today, Harvard's president mentioned how for more than three quarters of a century, federal dollars have helped pay for innovations in medicine, engineering, and other sciences.
Oh, and we may have lost Janaki again. That was NPR education reporter Janaki Mehta. Thank you so much, Janaki.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Rory McIlroy has been winning professional golf tournaments for more than 16 years. But the one that had always eluded him was the Masters in Augusta, Georgia. That is, until yesterday, his win made him just the sixth man to earn a career Grand Slam, victories in all four of golf's major championships. But as Steve Futterman reports, he did not make it easy on himself.
Rory McIlroy repeatedly squandered what seemed to be an insurmountable lead. It started at the very first hole. McIlroy, admittedly nervous, ended up with a double bogey. His two-stroke lead was gone. By the 13th hole, he had built up a three-stroke lead. Then he hit the ball into a creek, and soon that lead was also gone. On the 18th, up by one, McIlroy needed to make just a simple four-foot putt to win, and amazingly, he missed it. The startled crowd couldn't believe it. That forced a sudden-death playoff. On the first hole, McIlroy faced with a three-foot putt, and a history of disappointment at Augusta sank it.
The long journey is over. McIlroy has his masterpiece.
The call on CBS, McIlroy collapsed to the ground, sobbing into his hands. At last, he had captured the one major tournament missing from his resume, the Masters. Now the crowd celebrated.
Rory, 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 Rory,
Marco Moretto from Montreal, Canada, couldn't believe what he had seen.
This was incredible sporting drama. He is an amazing champion. He showed grit, he showed determination, he showed how mentally tough he is.
Soon afterwards, McIlroy was presented with the famed Masters green jacket by last year's winner, Scottie Scheffler.
And Scottie, I would be grateful if you would please do the honor of placing the green jacket on Rory.
McIlroy had been so close, so many times, with so much heartbreak for more than a decade, but could never quite win here.
Yeah, it's been difficult. It's been 14 long years, but thankfully I got the job done.
Greg Allen with RTE Irish Radio has been covering Rory McIlroy since he was 15.
He goes from being great to being someone who's undisputably a legend, because that's what goes with being a winner of the career Grand Slam.
McIlroy joins golf's royalty, Tiger Woods, Jack Nicklaus, Gary Player, Ben Hogan, and Gene Sarazen, as the only winners of all four majors, the U.S. Open, the British Open, the PGA, and now the Masters. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman in Augusta, Georgia.
It's been 20 years since the band OK Go released Here It Goes Again. But the tune isn't what most people remember. They remember the treadmills. In a grainy music video, the four guys in the band jump on and off moving treadmills in a choreographed dance. It cost them $5 to make. And it became one of the first viral music videos, blowing up on YouTube when the platform was still new and catapulting the band to fame. Two decades later, OK Go's music videos still regularly break the internet.
The reflection of a reflection of a reflection is always such a spectacularly exciting trick.
That's Damian Kulosh, lead singer of OK Go. The band's latest video for the song Love is a frantic journey through a kaleidoscope of mirrors hinging on robotic arms.
I remember standing between my parents' two closet doors that opened towards each other, and both had a full-length mirror on it, and you could see the infinite hallway.
So why not take that childhood memory and spend months making an elaborate one-take music video out of it? I asked Kulosh what it's been like to spend his career in the churn of internet virality.
I think of it as being a strange goal to have, you know? Like, we've never particularly chased the attention side of that. It's just the thing that has fueled our ability to keep making these, right? We get to make these really ridiculous and elaborate and wonderful art projects that there really isn't a cultural form for outside of this, right? Like, we couldn't walk into a gallery and be like, listen, we have some art to make. It's going to take a month, and, you know, lots and lots of robots and a few hundred mirrors. And after that month, we will have gotten it to work for precisely 3 minutes. You know, like, right. That's not...
This is not a Marina Abramovich performance art piece.
Exactly. And you can't take it to a movie studio and go, like, I got your four-quadrant multi-tentpole summer hit. You know, like, this is not how films are normally made. This is not how art is normally made. And it's not even what musicians normally do. And we've stumbled into this place where we get to chase these crazy art projects, and we love it so, so much. And it's such a gift. And it's also... It's not that well suited to the modern version of virality. Like, what people do now with the internet, like, we were part of the move from cable to YouTube, right? Like, we had the biggest thing on MTV and VH1, which was the thing that shifted everybody to YouTube, right? Our treadmill video was the thing that sort of broke MTV.
I have to tell you, even today, I said to a friend, oh, I'm interviewing OK Go this week. And he said, oh, the treadmill guys.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be on our tombstones. And like at the time when we put that out, we decided to put it on YouTube because we got an email from chad@youtube.com, the guy who founded YouTube, saying, mm-hmm. I've seen your stuff online. You should put it on my site. Like, that's how small all of this was at the time. And now virality is something like... I mean, first of all, it's kind of purchasable, right? And second, it's mostly done by people gaming algorithms. It doesn't mean the same thing that it did, and it also was never something we were looking for. What we wanted was to make the art project, and if this allows us to keep doing it, then awesome.
So I know that you have to present yourselves as a band, and bands make music videos, but when you're privately thinking about who you are, is it multimedia artists? Is it short filmmakers who also make music? Is it like, obviously this is more than just a band making a music video. How do you, this is such a pretentious phrase, describe your creative practice?
Wonder toucher. Ew! No, but that's the thing, is that like, I don't really think of myself as a storyteller in the sense that I don't usually think that it's important, the narrative part of this. The arc is really important. The surprise is really important. The choreography is really important. But it's mostly that feeling that you get when Roberta Flack is singing and suddenly you don't know if you're trying to smile or you're trying to cry, but mm-hmm. both have to happen simultaneously. That thing that can't be done through my vocabulary or my rational thinking, that's the magic that we're always chasing, and I feel like it's there in music, and it's there in film, and it's there in everything.
That's Damian Kulosh of the band OK Go. In another part of the show, we'll talk more about their new album and the adjacent possible.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. Fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. My
mom gave me a nickel to buy a pickle. Well, I didn't buy a pickle. I bought some chewing gum. Chew, 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 chewing gum. How I love chewing gum. Well, I'm crazy over chewing gum. I chew, chew, chew. My aunt gave me a quarter for soda water. Well, I didn't buy the water. I bought some chewing gum. Chew, 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 chewing gum. How I love chewing gum. Well, I'm crazy over chewing gum. What can I do? I chew all day away, it seems. I'm even blowing bubbles in my dream. My pop gave me a dollar to buy.